Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Yes, thank you, Estelle. Coming up on today's show, the UN Refugee Summit cemented a dedication to protect the rights of refugees and asylum seekers this week and saw 50 nations pledge to double the number of refugees they resettle. But some human rights organisations have criticised the summit for failing to develop an overarching strategy.
Massive disruptions have gripped the Venezuelan capital of Caracas over the last 24 hours as bus drivers blockade the streets demanding a fare hike, totally paralysing the city.
Oxfam have today highlighted the situation in Yemen, stating that the ongoing conflict and Saudi-led bombing campaign has pushed the country to, quote, the brink of catastrophe. The report was released just hours after the US Senate voted against a resolution that would have blocked the sale of arms to Saudi Arabia.
Campaign group Transparency International has revealed that there are nearly 40,000 lobbyists working in Brussels, roughly the same number as the total number of EU employees.
And a new internet tool, the Trump Twitter Archive, claims to shed light on the extent of the Republican presidential candidate's vocabulary.
All that and more over the next half hour on this Thursday edition of World in Focus.
The United Nations Summit for Refugees and Migrants took place this week in New York. On Monday, 193 countries adopted commitments to enhance protections for millions of people who have been forcibly displaced.
On Tuesday, 50 countries and organisations participating in the summit increased their contributions to humanitarian appeals in 2016 by $4.5 billion, including $1 billion from the United States, according to President Barack Obama's opening address. President Obama also used his speech to the summit to highlight the plight of refugees around the globe.
We are facing a crisis of epic proportions. More than 65 million people have been driven from their homes, which is more than any time since the Second World War. Among them are more than 21 million refugees who have fled their countries. Everything and everyone they've ever known, fleeing with a suitcase or the clothes on their back. And I'm here today, I called this summit, because this crisis is one of the most urgent tests of our time, our capacity for collective action. It tests, first and foremost, our ability to end conflicts, because so many of the world's refugees come from just three countries ravaged by war, Syria, Afghanistan, and Somalia. And I said today to the General Assembly, the mentality that allows for violence with impunity is something we cannot excuse. And collectively, we continue to make excuses.
President Barack Obama speaking at the UN summit on Tuesday.
Many aid organisations have welcomed the outcome of the summit, which has seen the 50 countries taking part pledge to double the number of refugees they collectively admit to more than 360,000. But many organisations have criticised the summit, stating that some world leaders turned the event into a political point-scoring exercise and failed to address the underlying issues contributing to the global refugee crisis.
One such critic is Bill Frelick, the director of the Refugee Programme for Human Rights Watch. I spoke to Bill earlier today and I began by asking him precisely why he believed that the summit had failed refugees.
Well, we're at a critical moment of history. Right now, the frontline states that really bear the bulk of the world's refugees have made it absolutely clear that they've reached their limit, they've reached their capacity, and they're closing their borders. The Jordanian border has an earthen berm now with 75,000 plus Syrian refugees that are stranded and not allowed to come in. The Turkish border, we have reports of guards shooting at asylum seekers trying to reach safety in Turkey. The Kenyan government has said that it's going to close the largest refugee camp in the world in Dadaab in November and is already putting enormous pressure on refugees to return to Somalia. And Pakistan is coercing Afghan refugees to return to Afghanistan. This is the absolute imperative that is facing the international community. The very institution of asylum is at risk. The fundamental principle of non-refoulement, of not returning refugees, is being openly violated. And many of the speeches were either sort of vapid platitudes that didn't seem to take into account what's actually happening on the ground, or reiterations of get tough you know, we need to control our borders and contain these movements.
Do you think then that the UN summit turned into more of a political point-scoring event than something that was concerned with the humanitarian side?
I mean, it had some positive aspects. You know, there were some good language against xenophobia, against race hatred. There were, in fact, some commitments for increasing funding and some modest increases in refugee resettlement, but clearly not enough for the challenge that the world is faced with at the moment.
We have seen some targets set, and of course targets give us quantitative measures by which we can hold governments to account, but do specific figures and targets get in the way of an overarching strategy worldwide?
I think that's right. And I think one of the failures of the summits, one of the key failures, was the initial plan, I think, was really to expand the scope of protection to include migrants who don't meet the very narrow 1951 Refugee Convention definition of a well-founded fear of persecution, but people who are fleeing generalized violence. They're really the more common reasons for millions of people to flee their countries. And these are not people who are just seeking better economic opportunities. These are people who are fleeing for their lives in many cases because of generalized violence, because of the effects of climate change. And these are people who need protection. And yet the declaration, the New York Declaration that was negotiated this summer, changed the wording from an earlier draft that acknowledged that they needed protection to say they only need assistance. And that's simply not the case. It's not enough to just try to figure out, you know, whether you're going to be dropping food by crane or by airplane to the Syrian asylum seekers that are stranded at the Jordanian border. You have to let them in. You have to protect them. You can't reject them and push them back into a place where their lives are being threatened. That's the key question, and that's the question that was really avoided.
Bill Frelick from Human Rights Watch there, and we'll be hearing again from Bill in just a few moments.
So there was another announcement this week which could go some way towards addressing the dangers of migratory routes. The European Investment Bank has announced that it will be lending $200 million to the African nation of Ethiopia. The investment will be used to build two industry parks which will seek to employ 30,000 refugees.
The bank said on Wednesday that this move would help curb the flow of refugees to Europe. Ethiopia currently hosts over 700,000 refugees. The president of the European Investment Bank, Werner Hoyer, said, quote, "We know that Ethiopia is for many a stopping point before making the dangerous onward journey to final destinations in Europe." I asked Human Rights Watch's Bill Frelick if he thought that schemes like this could form part of a solution to the wider refugee crisis, or whether this may result in the exploitation of vulnerable people.
Well, I think it could do either. On my first view of this is that it's a great initiative, that basically what you need to do in these countries of first arrival, and Ethiopia is one of them, is to really improve the conditions of asylum so that people are not kept in camps, that people are allowed to be productive, they're allowed to contribute economically to the countries in which they're living, and to live in dignity. And that means, you know, being able to be authorized to work, not to be exploited, and to be able to send their children to school. This is, you know, one of the key goals of the summit, and I think it's a great goal. The numerical goals, I think, were a bit modest, only sending 1 million children to school and 1 million refugees authorized to work. I think they could have done far better than that. But the initiative itself, I think, is a very good one. The caveat I have on some of the framework agreements between the European Union and Africa more broadly is that a lot of the funding and a lot of these agreements are really conditional on stopping migration movements. And a lot of the money that's going in is really going in for border control, for police enforcement, for preventing countries like Eritrea from allowing their own citizens to leave in the name of anti-trafficking, in the name of anti-smuggling. And I think, you know, when you look at it more closely, what's really at work here is a strategy to prevent migrants from moving and asylum seekers from seeking asylum rather than something that's really aimed at ending criminality.
Mm. Well, Bill Frelick, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Still to come on the programme, massive disruptions have gripped the Venezuelan capital of Caracas over the last 24 hours as bus drivers blockade the streets demanding a fare hike, totally paralysing the city.
Oxfam have today highlighted the situation in Yemen, stating that the ongoing conflict and Saudi-led bombing campaign has pushed the country to, quote, the brink of catastrophe. The report was released just hours after the US Senate voted against a resolution that would have blocked the sale of arms to Saudi Arabia.
Campaign group Transparency International has revealed that there are nearly 40,000 lobbyists working in Brussels. That's roughly the same as the total number of EU employees.
And we'll be looking at the new tool that allows you to search the online for Donald Trump's insults on Twitter. Exciting stuff. The Venezuelan capital, Caracas, has been facing massive disruption over the last 24 hours as bus drivers completely blockaded the city streets in a part demonstration, part strike. Despite some sections of the media covering this in the context of opposition to President Maduro's government, it really has more to do with demands for fare hikes, something which will require government backing due to strict price controls applied to goods and services in Venezuela.
The bus system in Caracas is not publicly owned, so its drivers represent a patchwork of small business and owner-operators, rather than one homogenous unionised industry. It is perhaps for this reason that the action has not been officially called a strike, rather it's a caravan, whose purpose was the delivery of a strongly worded document to the Transport Minister, Ricardo Molina.
With me on the line now from Caracas is the economist and environmental analyst, Annabella Abadi. Thank you for talking to us, Annabella. What's the situation right now in Caracas? Are things back to normal yet?
Well, by 8 o'clock last night, we thought we would wake up with a national strike of buses. It didn't happen. The thing is, the national government called drivers to sit down and negotiate a fare hike. So for now, the situation is pretty much back to normal, but there should be an official announcement next Thursday. So there will probably be a fare hike.
And how does that, I mean, obviously I can understand why bus drivers would be looking for a fare hike, especially at the moment in the current economic climate in Venezuela. But from the perspective of people using those buses, that surely can't be good news.
Yeah, it's pretty bad news, especially for those that make minimum wage. But the thing is, the question tends to be, how much should a person make to be able to pay for transportation? But the real question should be, why are the bus drivers asking for a fare hike? And the answer for that is inflation, that is affecting not only commuters, but also bus drivers. Mm. The government is doing pretty much nothing to fight inflation, so it's affecting everyone.
Many people might be surprised to understand that, as far as I understand it, despite the socialist government that's been in place in Venezuela for some years now, Caracas has no publicly owned bus network per se. Rather, it's lots of small business owner-operators. I mean, how does that square with a government that you would expect would have nationalized something as basic as public transport?
Yeah, when we talk about public transport, we are usually talking about buses. It doesn't mean that it's owned by the government per se. Mm. The thing is that the fares tend to be controlled or fixed, and they are pretty low. Right now, drivers are asking for a fare hike because they can't even afford to keep the units properly maintained. The government gives money to drivers. They tend to approve some sort of subsidized. Mm. But right now, the drivers are saying that the government is not paying what the government agreed to pay, so the fare is not enough to maintain the unit.
Now, obviously, there's a complicated political climate at the moment as well in Venezuela, with the context of the opposition calls for a recall referendum against President Maduro. Given that the bus drivers involved in this are essentially small business owner-operators, would it be overly simplistic to assume that the strike might be dominated by people who are opposed to Maduro's government and supportive of the opposition moves towards a recall referendum?
Yeah, I think it would be rather simplistic. There are public enterprises, meaning businesses owned by the government, where the workers usually strike asking for higher wages. So these type of strikes come from both the central government enterprises and from private enterprises. In any case, anyone that lives in Venezuela and makes bolívares has difficulties meeting month's end. We don't have enough money, so any type of worker is right now protesting or calling for strikes in order to make more money, but the inflation is eating up that money.
Presumably this plays into the argument from the opposition, though, that things are reaching crisis point in Venezuela.
Well, we're in the midst of a crisis, both in the political sphere and economical sphere. We're not sure where this is going to end at. Many say that we Venezuelans have a lot of patience because this is the worst crisis we've faced in our history, and yet we are still waiting. Right now, the opposition is hoping for a referendum in 2016, a recall referendum. After a couple of press releases, we're not sure this is going to happen in 2016. It will probably happen in 2017. And it's pretty far away considering the circumstances.
Well, Anabella Abadi, thank you very much for talking to us.
Sure, thanks.
A report by Oxfam today has highlighted the situation in Yemen, currently in the midst of a civil war and a wide-scale Saudi-led bombing campaign. The Oxfam report, entitled Picking Up the Pieces, calls for an immediate ceasefire in Yemen, stating that the country is, quote, on the brink of catastrophe.
The report highlights the severe humanitarian crisis in Yemen, which earlier this year Oxfam referred to as Syria without the cameras, as it's often too dangerous for journalists to travel into the country and to report on the conflict. Several aid organisations have been forced to withdraw their services from Yemen. Most recently, Médecins Sans Frontières had to close six of their hospitals in northern Yemen after they were hit by airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition forces, killing at least 19 people.
One of the recommendations of the report was that the international community should suspend the supply of weapons to all parties involved. That recommendation has already been dealt a blow, given that just yesterday the US Senate voted against a resolution that would have blocked the sale of arms to Saudi Arabia.
The resolution, which was put forward by Republican Senator Rand Paul and Democratic Senator Chris Murphy, sought to halt the sale of $1.15 billion of tanks and other military equipment to Saudi Arabia on the basis of the Gulf nation's human rights record and involvement in the conflict in Yemen. Rand Paul used his speech during the Senate debate to highlight the role the United States was playing in the Yemeni conflict.
There's probably no greater issue before Congress at any time in our lives or any time in our service than whether or not we should go to war. And I think it's a mistake to slide into war. I think it's a mistake to allow the power to declare war to devolve to one person. Our founding fathers were very, very clear throughout the Federalist Papers, explicitly in the Constitution, that the power to declare war shouldn't go to one person, that the power to declare war should be determined by a vote of Congress. We have abdicated that role, and the vote today is a vote over whether or not we should try to reclaim that power. Now, some will say, well, it's just arms, and if we don't sell them, somebody else will. Well, you know, I don't think of national security as a jobs program. I don't think of whether we create jobs here at home. I think about the young man who lives down the road from me who lost both legs and an arm, okay? I think about the human toll of war. I think about whether or not there is a national security interest, but I think nothing at all about whether any jobs are created.
Republican Senator Rand Paul speaking in the US Senate. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy echoed his sentiment in a talk on Capitol Hill in June. According to a report by Defense News, Chris Murphy said, quote, if you talk to Yemeni Americans, they will tell you in Yemen, this isn't a Saudi bombing campaign. It's a US bombing campaign. Every single civilian death inside Yemen is attributable to the United States. We accept that as a consequence of our participation, end quote.
Their resolution, however, was rejected in the Senate yesterday, with 71 voting against the resolution and 27 voting to uphold the block on the arms sale. Joining me on the line now is the author and former South African MP, Andrew Feinstein. Andrew, does this decision cement the United States' political support of Saudi Arabia?
Oh, absolutely. I think that political support was called into question when the United States led the move to make peace with Iran, much to the opposition of Saudi Arabia and Israel. But I think the fact that they have continued to sell weapons, both while negotiating that Iran deal and post the deal, is ample evidence that they certainly don't want to alienate Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm. Senator Chris Murphy, who put forward the resolution with Rand Paul, said that his aim wasn't necessarily to pass the resolution, but was to apply pressure to Saudi Arabia for its role in the Yemeni conflict. Do you think that the fact that the resolution was voted against by 71 to 27 perhaps is counterproductive to that aim of applying pressure?
Oh, absolutely. I think the provision of weapons to Saudi Arabia, given their role, not just in Yemen, which I'll come to in a moment, but in the region generally, you know, they're using tanks, which is what America has primarily sold to them now, to keep down democracy protests in Bahrain, to ensure that that undemocratic regime stays in power. They're using all sorts of weaponry and equipment in Syria, which is simply complicating that conflict and making it more bloody. And as for Yemen itself, it really is worth bearing in mind that since the bombing campaign, which has been led by Saudi Arabia, started in March of 2015, over 10,000 people have lost their lives. And a conservative estimate says that of those, at least 3,800 are innocent civilians. So there are massive human rights abuses being committed. The rules of law are being violated. Fully one-third, at least, of all of the bombings are targeted at schools, places of worship, places of residence, hospitals. So violating the rules of law, violating the International Arms Trade Treaty. So the fact that the United States continues to sell weapons to America while all of this is going on is frankly laughable to suggest that this will in any way put pressure on them, even though the fact that 27 senators voted against the arms sale is hugely significant, because that is probably the most number of elected representatives that have voted against an arms sale to Saudi Arabia since the 1980s in America, when Saudi was seen as a threat to Israel.
Mm. And Rand Paul said that during the debates in Senate that America was now at war with Yemen through the refueling of Saudi's arms. Do you think that nations that are fueling Saudi, like the UK being one of the biggest, should be held responsible and should have accountability to what then happens with those arms in Yemen?
Absolutely. The United States and the United Kingdom, who, by the way, has provided Saudi Arabia with 3.3 billion pounds of weapons since March of this year. And in the case of the United Kingdom, a huge number of those weapons are the very bombs and missiles that are falling on Yemen and killing innocent civilians, including the 19 innocent people who were killed yesterday. I think that these countries should be held to account. I think that for the United States and the United Kingdom to suggest that it is any way has the moral standing to criticize any other government in its conduct when it is effectively enabling the killing of thousands and thousands of civilians in Yemen, even if it is through a proxy like Saudi Arabia, is completely unacceptable. And I think shows just the day after International Peace Day how broken the global diplomatic system is.
Well, Andrew Feinstein, thank you very much for joining
us. Thanks a lot.
As an investigation gets underway over ex-EU Chief Barroso's role as lobbyist for Goldman Sachs, campaign group Transparency International has revealed that there are nearly 40,000 lobbyists working in Brussels. That's roughly the same number as the total number of EU employees. There was an outcry when former President of the European Commission, José Manuel Barroso, was appointed non-executive chairman of Goldman Sachs International at a chief lobbyist only 20 months after leaving office.
It highlighted the increasingly bitter debate over the amount of lobbying going on in Brussels behind closed doors, epitomised by the secretive nature of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, CETA, or the Trade in Services Agreement, TISA negotiations. Our reporter, Jim Ensom, has been following this story. Jim, what have Transparency International found?
Well, Jack, it's fascinating. What they've looked at is they've looked at the voluntary lobbying list. Now, at the moment, lobbyists have to register themselves in European Union, but only on a voluntary basis, and that's a major issue. But what they've done is they've looked at it, the whole list, And they found out that actually if you strip away some of the ones that are a bit spurious, they reckon there's about 37,350 lobbyists involved in Brussels. 26,000 of those, just over 26,000, hold at least one lobby pass for the parliament or have had access to the high-level meetings. Now, what I did was when I saw that, I immediately went onto the European Union website and I thought, well, if there are around about 37,500 lobbyists, how many people are actually employed in the whole of the EU? And I'll quote you this. According to the Integrity Watch, according to the European Union, around about 33,000 people are employed by the European Commission, around 6,000 in the European Parliament, and around 3,500 in the General Secretariat. Now, that adds up to 45,500. Now, so if there are 45,500 employees, and there are 37,500 lobbyists, that's not far off a one-to-one ratio of lobbyists against pen pushers.
Wow. But who's doing all this lobbying?
Fundamentally, they're the pharmaceuticals, they're the banks for financial services, and the big businesses. Because when the EU is making up EU directives, etc., and also, most importantly, the TTIP agreement, the CETA agreement, and the TISA agreement, those big trade deals they're working on, when it comes to making law and directives and deciding what powers Brussels will have, big business wants to have a say in it. They want to say, well, if you're making these laws, we want to have a say in what it is. It's a lot of it's to do with regulatory and transparency issues. And yet the irony is there is very little transparency over the amount of lobbying that goes on, because it's only absolutely after a lot of pressure from European parliamentarians that they've actually put together a voluntary register of lobbyists. And that does not necessarily include the total number of them who aren't actually registering voluntarily.
Jim, we're very, very short for time, so just very briefly, why should we be concerned about this?
I think it's all to do with the general dysfunctionality of the way the European Union is working and the fact that they are remote from people. If people are doing deals that the voters in Europe can't see and they're being seen to be doing deals behind the scenes and to be seen to be using a lot of lobbying money, then I think it's bad for democracy, and that's fundamentally what Transparency International have said.
Jim Ensom, thank you.
And finally, the US Republican candidate for president, Donald Trump, has made a name for himself on Twitter as being pretty outspoken. In fact, he's made a name for himself in general as being pretty outspoken, and I'm pretty sure that plenty of people would use less diplomatic terms than that to describe his often abrasive style.
Yes, but Twitter is where the creators of a new online archive have gone for inspiration. The Trump Twitter Archive is a completely searchable database of every tweet ever posted by Donald Trump. Sounds like fun. But it's also got a special section devoted to the billionaire presidential candidate's most commonly used words, phrases and themes. Themes like global warming.
It'll get cooler, it'll get warmer, it's called weather.
I'm not a believer in global warming. I'm not a believer in man-made global warming.
I think it's a big scam for a lot of people to make a lot of money.
So if I take hairspray, and if I spray it in my apartment, which is all sealed, and you're telling me that affects the ozone layer, I say, no way, folks, no way.
I know a lot about wind. Wind is killing the birds.
It's like record cold. And I keep hearing about global warming. Now they'll say, he doesn't understand. This is a worldwide problem. Oh, no, I don't understand. Let's do IQ tests.
I believe there's weather. I believe there's change. And I believe it goes up and it goes down and it goes up again.
If only there was some method by which you could test these things so you didn't have to rely on belief.
That was, of course, Donald Trump talking about global warming, one of his favourite themes on Twitter. And as you probably gathered there, he really doesn't believe in it. The Trump Twitter Archive, which you can while away the hours yourself at TrumpTwitterArchive.com.
That's my evening sorted.
Yes, it also seemed to think that his favourite word is loser.
Loser?
Yes, loser.
Well, presumably we've got some clips of him saying loser lined up.
Funny you should say that. Yes, we do.
We have losers. We have losers.
Well, Rosie's a loser. She's always been a loser.
She suffers from a thing called loser's remorse. She lost.
They're losers. They're just losers.
Cher is somewhat of a loser. She's lonely. She's unhappy.
We have losers.
Jack, how long did you spend today looking for clips of Donald Trump saying the word loser.
It took a surprisingly short amount of time. You'd be surprised.
I hadn't heard that until just
I was
now.
Busy doing proper news most of the day. I mean, that's not how I spent my afternoon. Unfortunately, though, that is all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget that you can listen again to this and to previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we hand over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartman Show. And until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott.
And from me, Jack Foster. Goodbye.